For many decades, I have said that the last chapter of European history has not been written. I've gone out to personal appearance campaigns and in the Many America Listen campaigns and in dozens of weekly Sabbath services and special church visits and talked about an eventual United States of Europe. I think you all remember that when I wrote the booklet, United Europe, How Soon?, which was really from an article that I had used in the 1990 special edition of 20th Century Watch magazine, in which I went back and researched 54 separate quotations from our publications going all the way back to the 1940s, the late 1940s, as World War II was waning, saying that Europe was going to unite, and that when I mentioned the last chapter of European history is not written, it was in the context of a divided Europe, a divided Berlin, of the Cold War, which has been running, by the way, sequentially on CNN, and they've had quite a series of documentaries on the Cold War, reminding us of what a near thing it was, time and time again, virtually going right to war with Russia, especially over the Kennedy-Khrushchev missile standoff in Cuba. Well, when the Berlin Wall came down, I really expected quite a flurry of media personnel beating a path to my door. Because Mark and David and I grabbed that television camera and we took off for Berlin. And we were over there for one of the greatest celebrations I've ever been a party to or witness to, of these East Europeans and East Berliners coming across, and the West Berliners had really just gone all out to welcome them. And families had set up just corner stores where they had bought and put out cartons of every kind of fruit, apples and oranges and bananas and soft drinks and candies and things which simply weren't available in the East. And here were people that were giving away as well as selling some of these items of produce, and outside a couple of the police stations, because we walked all over Charlottenstrasse and some of the main streets in Berlin that night when they were just thronging the streets by the thousands. They were locking arms, they were marching down the streets, they were all closed off to vehicular traffic, and there were hundreds of thousands of people celebrating. Outside the police stations, there were policemen with coffee and hot chocolate urns who were giving free drinks to their East Berliners who suddenly had been reunited when for all of these many, many years they'd been divided. If you had ever been there and had gone to the museum at Checkpoint Charlie, you would have seen some of the astonishing film as well as the pictures that are being portrayed now in the series being run by CNN. People who literally would fling themselves against that barbed wire to be shot right while they're clinging there. And you would see the little tiny, they look just like the kind of a little cart that a man makes to work on his back beneath his automobile. And they had dug tunnels for hundreds of yards. And there'd be a little wire by which they would propel themselves lying on their backs with little pieces of wood and little wooden wheels as they would come beneath that no man's land dividing East and West Berlin. And that many people died because freedom, simply being free and out from under the heel of a brutal communist dictatorship and the ever-present Stasi keeping track of everyone in a police society, even if they died in the attempt, was to be desired instead of living in that kind of a stifling society. Well, I think for decades what I said fell on deaf ears, because when you consider when that wall went up and how long Europe lay under the heel of communist domination and how long the Cold War continued, no one could have guessed that when President Reagan began the Star Wars Initiative, as it was called by the press, actually a strategic anti-ballistic missile system placed in space, which they are still talking about even today, but it would have been incredibly costly. But because the Soviet Union simply could not keep up in the gigantic expenditures on borrowed money, of course, that we and the American government were putting into that kind of R&D, as they call it, research and development, in many of our highly skilled defense contractors and in technology, they virtually just gave up. But also there were a lot of other elements to that, not the least of which was Karol Wojtyla and Poland and the Roman Catholic Church and a secret CIA funneling of tremendous amounts of money to the Catholic Church in Poland to keep alive their various publishing infrastructure, to keep the people aware of what Solidarity was doing, an awful lot of other inputs that eventually resulted and Gorbachev, not the least of which, because he was very instrumental in it, in prying loose the grip of the Soviet Union from Eastern Europe. I'll tell you a little more about that toward the end of what I have to say, but in this television program coming up on Monday, I'm going to be reading some very shocking material. I've been reading it all morning. I've been underlining it in a national weekly headline in London, and in the annual Economist publication, and in publications in Germany, and in speeches given since his investiture as the new German Chancellor by Gerhard Schröder, and in a speech made day before yesterday in Germany by the German Foreign Minister. He said, "We are wanting to see full European political unity." And a statement about a European Union becoming a political federation, one state. He used the terms a European state. Now, Germany not only launches the EKU, as it was called, or the United Europe Currency, on January 1st, 1999, but at that moment, Germany assumes from England the presidency of the European Union. And in a very lengthy address, which I read this morning from Gerhard Schröder, who was their new chancellor, he went into their security responsibilities, and he mentioned specifically Kosovo and the Middle East. And he had some very fine words to say for the young Wehrmacht people who are in Kosovo and in Bosnia and Herzegovina, who are helping to keep the peace there, about German troops that would be eventually injected into regional disputes, and he even mentioned specifically the Middle East. In his very lengthy 25-page, I have it at home, all marked up now, probably should have brought it and read a little bit of it to you, but I didn't want to read my way through this sermon today, but in that press release, he addressed, first of all, Nuncio, and then he talked about the other dignitaries, and then ladies and gentlemen. Do all of you know whom he addressed when he said Nuncio? Well, that would be the papal nuncio. And a papal nuncio is, in effect, the ambassador from the Vatican. And he was the most important single individual in that audience when Gerhard Schröder made his, in effect, State of the Union address upon taking office as the new German chancellor. Will you turn to Revelation, the 17th chapter, and refresh your memories a little bit? This chapter of the Bible, written by John, probably around 92 AD, really is almost totally self-explanatory. And yet there are so many other prophecies in the Bible that bear upon this that show that there is to be a union of church and state at the very time when the church is to be driven completely down and out and into hiding, but will not any longer be allowed to conduct any organized preaching of the gospel over any of the electronic media, and perhaps even meet in peace as we are here today without fear of being discovered and betrayed and hauled off to a torture camp somewhere. In the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation, John, remember, is seeing all of this in vision. There came one of the seven angels which had the seven vials. They were the ones that poured out the wrath of God upon the earth, and talked with me, saying, "Come hither, and I will show unto you the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters." Now, a great harlot, or a madam, who sits astride many waters, as you will see a little later on, is a symbol of a great church that has membership in all nations, many waters, meaning multitudes in many, many different nations, with whom the kings of the earth, now you can read presidents, premiers, or prime ministers if you like, because it means the leaders and the heads of state, have committed fornication. And that is merely biblical metaphor for having political concourse with a spiritual so-called organization. We in the United States are so unfamiliar with that because we are based upon the principle of separation of church and state, even though there are tremendous and flagrant violations of that, for example, in blue laws, or even playing the very loud church-oriented music that they do out of the loudspeakers on a Tuesday, but that's another subject. But there are an awful lot of violations of that in the United States, but primarily we're based upon the principle of the separation of church and state. You remember that many, many people were very concerned when we elected for the first time, when John Kennedy was elected, a Catholic president, And he was asked directly, to whom will you bear ultimate allegiance, the Pope in Rome or the American Constitution? And of course, he vacillated a little bit, but he basically said to the Constitution. But people wanted to know, because all Catholics say that their ultimate authority is the Pope in Rome. And they wanted to know, do you have a man with double allegiance here? With whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication. In all the history of the world, until the last 5 or so years, there had never been an ambassador representing the Jews, not as a religion and certainly not as a state, because Jewish statehood did not come about until 1948. And from 1948 until the 1990s, there was never an exchange of ambassadors between the Vatican and formerly Tel Aviv, now Jerusalem, or the Jewish state. Now there has been, as you well know. And I've told you time and again what some of the Jewish leadership, including their foreign minister, have said about the status of Jerusalem. And lo and behold, even after this latest push and shove and threatening match between Saddam Hussein and President Clinton and our allies, a few of whom got on board, Britain primarily, the most of them didn't, and a threat of action in the Gulf, the Pope spoke up once again, right in the midst of that, calling for a special status for Jerusalem, that Jerusalem should be an internationalized city and nobody's political capital, and should be overseen by like a second Vatican, that there should be like a Vatican administration of the holy places under the auspices of the Roman Catholic Church. That has been proposed time and again, and even the Israelis have gone along with a little bit of that, talking about the old city, but not their own Knesset, which is in what most people call New Jerusalem, that has been really built and built up there since 1948. All right, well, so much to understand then about the kings of the earth having political concourse with a great universal church. And the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. Verse 6 says, I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. Now, spiritual drunkenness is merely spiritual deception, spiritual blindness, and it means the false doctrines of that great fallen church. The word wine is oinos. I only say this in passing, like a Bible study, to expound the verses as we go along. And wherever in the New Testament the Greek word wine, including for the Passover, is used, it is O-I-N-O-S, and you can hear wine, our English word, in it, oinos, and wine, or vino, V-I-N-O in the Latin, coming from vine, actually, and having to do with the fruit of the vine. So vino is wine in Spanish, and of course, vin, V-I-N, coming from vine in French, and oinos in the Greek. And it does mean that she was drunk, not just sated, not having drunken too much grape juice, but drunk with the wine of her fornication. So what does it prove? It absolutely proves that the wine that Jesus used at the Passover was wine, which if you drink enough of, can get you drunk. That's why it should be taken only in moderation. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and he sees himself going into an uninhabited land. And I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, a strange creature, full of names of blasphemy. Where he saw the names, I don't know, but just like names written or etched or placarded all over her or it, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. You can imagine an old harlot, an old madam, running some kind of a brothel and using a little tub to clean up and putting all the garbage and the filth and the stuff that you can't even imagine and want to talk about into a golden cup. That is so untoward that it's almost unspeakable. Now, people have tried to draw this picture. I remember when I was a boy that ministers who would come around as an evangelist in the Church of God Seventh Day would have a huge big canvas painting behind them. And it would show this woman sitting on this beast that had all these heads and all these many horns, and it had all kinds of names on it. I remember that very well. I also remember the kind of covers that we used to put on our booklets that had to do with the beast or the image of the beast or the mark of the beast back in the worldwide church in the 60s and 70s. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. Now, my margin says, the mother of fornications as well as harlots and abominations of the earth. Maybe many of you have read a book by Hyslop that is blackballed by the Roman Catholic Church called The Two Babylons. I have a couple of copies of that, one of which is very well marked up, of course, and referred to it from time to time, as I did in this latest booklet on Christmas. Mystery, the mystery religion, is a religion in which it is all in symbolism and even oftentimes in languages that the adherents could not understand. This was commonplace in the conversion process of many heathen races and nations in the Western Hemisphere. When the Catholic Church began to send missionaries who were among the earliest explorers and people who were colonizers in the West, and that's where the great missions, that's what they were called because they were housing missionaries along the mission trail in California all the way from up around San Francisco down to San Diego and all through, of course, Arizona, New Mexico, and perhaps even into southwestern Texas where these missions were established. And the priests would not speak to these people in their own language, but when they would call them together for a religious service, it would be conducted in Latin, and they would go through all the various signs. Without belaboring it, I think one of the greatest examples of the melding of paganism and the Roman Catholic religion was in a baptismal font that I saw that was in the National Museum in Mexico City when I went there with Dr. Benjamin Ray in 1954 for my first visit down to Mexico City. And here was Quetzalcoatl, which is their serpentine snake figure, whose tail formed the base of the font, and then his coils, ever larger, formed the actual baptismal font, and then here was just like a bird bath, a place for water, but with the head of the serpent beneath it, so that the heathen could come to the priest with his garb and his cross, and they could have water sprinkled upon them from a font that depicted their god, Quetzalcoatl. And Quetzal means bird, and Coatl means snake or serpent, so it was a flying bird. Mystery religion, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw a woman drunken with the blood of saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. It's a wonder to me that the people who wrote, and I think Dr. Halley was a Briton, who wrote Halley's Handbook, were not all assassinated. But when you read the church history section of that Halley's Handbook, it is fascinating, especially the part about the persecutions during the Protestant Reformation and how over 900,000 people were put to death by being burned alive and by torture and all kinds of means and methods that were unspeakable. And that's what this is referring to, and all really all the way down through history from the second century on. I saw the woman drunken with the blood of saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus, and when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration, a very poor word, it doesn't mean in our sense of admiring it, but in great shock and awe and almost stupefaction. And the angel said unto me, wherefore didst you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the creature or the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. So we don't need to make up our mind what this means. We can wait and see because the angel himself explained it to John. The beast that you saw was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition. Now it was, and yet it was not at the time of John, and it is not at our time today, and they that dwell on the earth shall wonder whose names were not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world when they behold the beast that was and is not and yet is. That means that it is ready to rise, yet it is not presently visible. All the Bible commentaries know that the four great empires of Babylon, Persia, Greco-Macedonia, and Rome fulfilled the prophecy of Daniel, the second chapter, up until the last part of it in verse 35 of the Ten Toes. And the stone that is cut out without hands that smites the great image on its ten toes, the whole image topples to the ground, and it becomes a mountain. The stone that smote it becomes a mountain that fills the whole earth. It says that the Babylonian system, the head of gold, that is Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon, and the chest of silver, which was the great Persian Empire, and the belly and thighs of brass, that was Greco-Macedonia under Alexander, and then the divided east and west. And that's interesting because for a time, the five great patriarchs that resulted in only two patriarchs that were excommunicating each other when Byzantium or Constantinople was the eastern headquarters of the great universal church and Rome was the western headquarters, they both claimed to be the popes. They both claimed to be successors of St. Peter, and they were equally excommunicating each other, but basically through attrition and force of arms, and as a result of warfare, Rome emerged supreme. And eventually there were 10 nations allied together in the Holy Roman Empire, and they were divided east and west. And I think it's fascinating that today, and it obtained, of course, for over 40-some years during the Cold War, there were five of these nations that were in the eastern sphere of influence under the communists, and five of them in the western sphere under the Allies, but there could have been 10 nations that could have been allied together if you look at the ones that were primarily a part of the Holy Roman Empire in the past, and they did not include NATO. They didn't include Turkey, which is a member of NATO, which may eventually be brought into a unified Europe of some kind, which will include some of the Balkan states, and maybe even Russia, who knows, or one or two of the nations that have arisen as a result of the implosion of the former Soviet Union. But I'll get to that a little bit later on. Here is the mind that has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. Now, I've been to Rome, and on top of all of the seven hills, it is called what? You all remember very well, some of you in this room have been to Rome, and you've been to St. Peter's, and you've seen the Vatican and the Vatican Museum. It is the city of seven hills, and on top of each of those seven hills is a very important Catholic religious building, like a church or a basilica of some kind. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sitteth. It says in Isaiah 47, if we have time, we'll get to that, that it says that this great fallen woman that is a great universal church says, I will not know the loss of children, I will never be a widow, and it says that it has names of blasphemy, and she says, I am, and there is none beside me. And Jesus said, I am, before Abraham was, I am, and the God, the one of the God family that we know is Jesus Christ, who appeared to Moses, said, I am that I am. So you can understand what the names of blasphemy are. They are names and titles of God. You all know that Rome is called what? The Eternal City, isn't it? The Eternal City. That by itself is blasphemous. It always made me wonder when they launched the Titanic, and they boasted that it was unsinkable, as to whether or not God was simply going to show mankind that you cannot produce anything that nature itself, in the form of an iceberg or a typhoon, cannot sink. You shouldn't have called it unsinkable. Now, that's just speculation on my part. I have nothing to go on to prove that to you. But it makes me wonder, it was sort of chilling. If they hadn't said it was unsinkable, maybe that wouldn't have happened. I just don't know. There are seven kings, five are fallen, and one is, and the other is not yet come, and when he cometh, he must continue a short space. And the beast that was and is not, even he is the eighth, that is the eighth system, but of the seven that preceded it. And is of the seven, and will be the final system, because he goes into perdition or destruction. Now, I've said time and again, these next three verses, if you had only those three verses and you believed the following, that God exists and this scrap of scripture of three verses of the Bible is his word to mankind, and you knew nothing else, you could read these three verses and you would know a tremendous amount about what is to occur just prior to the second coming of Christ. And the ten horns which you saw, now we're saying that we're pretending that we didn't know that there was someone who wrote these verses we just read. We only have these three verses. Someone saw ten horns. We don't need to wonder how big they were, whether they were goat horns or elk horns or cattle horns. We just know that they are, or they represent, 10 kings. Mystery solved. Which have received no kingdom as yet. So they are like pretenders to the throne. They don't even have a kingdom, but they are of perhaps royal seed, or they're perhaps people who would be, if they could be installed in office, a king, but receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast, the creature. The creature that apparently has 10 horns. Now, I've said time and again, the power of a king, of course, is absolute power. It's unlimited power. The power of his raw materials, of his population, of his nation, of his armed forces, of his economy, and so on. These have one mind. That means they are agreed in policy and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. They all pool their power. So you have a multinational force. You have a multinational economy. You have a multinational leadership. A federation, if you will, of 10 nations. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. Look at all that we are told in only 3 verses. At the very time of the second coming of Christ, there are going to be 10 nations. They will be unified together. They will fight Christ. And Christ, when he comes, is going to be accompanied by people who are called and chosen and who stick to it and who don't ever give up because they are faithful. You're given a tremendous amount of information in only 3 verses of the Bible. You could forget any information that you need out of ancient history. You don't need to know Greek or Latin or Roman or Babylonian cuneiform or Persian. You don't need to know anything at all about Daniel 2, 4, 7, or 11. You don't need to know anything at all about Revelation 13 or even the preceding verses in Revelation 17. If you had those 3 verses alone, you would understand more about what is coming on the world scene than the CIA or the FBI or the National Security Council or the President or his cabinet or the Pentagon. If you would just believe it, because it is going to come to pass. Now, as I told my wife this morning, there are big doings afoot. Because when I got all that information off the internet this morning and sat there with a big yellow pencil and began underlining it, I probably should have brought a great deal of it to read to you today, but it would have taken a great deal of time because it's about that thick, of the pronouncement by the German foreign minister that they intend seeing a united Europe politically and are going to work toward that beginning right away. And that the German government takes over as the head of the European Union because they have a rotating presidency, and it had been a member of the British government who was the president of the EU. Now, at the very same time that the European currency, unified currency, is to be launched on January 1st, 1999, a little more than a month from now, the German government is seated as the president of the European Union. And at this very moment, 2 days ago, the foreign minister of Germany makes the statement of full political union is ahead, and they're going to be working on it. I can go back in my memory to a time when people would say to my father or to some of us who would preach about a coming United States of Europe, that's crazy, or you're nuts. Well, that will never occur. And I remember that even during the closing months of World War II, when my father was saying that Germany would emerge from defeat, the Nazis would go underground. And it was a book written by Theodore White, who was a known political and very astute analyst at that time, who wrote a number of books on the subject and was an advisor to presidents, called Fire in the Ashes. And of course, he was talking about the rubble of the ashes of Germany and about how there was still fire down there that would one day flame up once again. And there were books and books and books written back during the 40s and the early 50s by the likes of Brian Connells and T.H. Teatons and so many others that wrote books like Germany Will Try It Again was one of them. And Germany and the Old Nazis is another one. Germany Plots for the Kremlin is another one about a secret pact between Germany and the Kremlin for non-aggression so that neither one of them would have to worry about their back door while they pursued their own conquest and their own desire for empire. All right, well, going on in verse 15. The waters which you saw back in verse 2, where the whore sitteth are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. So different languages meaning different races. A multiracial, multinational group of people upon whom the whore or the great fallen woman sits. And the ten horns which you saw upon the beast, these shall hate the whore and shall make her desolate and naked and shall eat her flesh and burn her with fire. For God has put in their hearts to fulfill his will and to agree and to give their kingdom unto the beast until the words of God should be fulfilled. It says that they will receive power as kings 1 hour. We know that a day is a year being fulfilled by several scriptures in the Bible. On that basis, maybe we're only dealing here with a part of 1 year. I don't know. There is no real proof for that. All we can say is that it's a very short period of time. But if you will turn back now to the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel, I'm sorry, to the 11th chapter of the book of Isaiah, Isaiah 11, and look at this prophecy about the second coming of Christ, there is something toward the end of it that is absolutely unescapable. He prophesies about Jesus Christ, his first coming, as well as his second coming, in this one chapter, the branch that shall grow out of the roots of Jesse, and the spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge and the fear of the eternal, in verse 2 is a prophecy of Christ. Make him of quick understanding, and he shall not judge after the sight of his eyes, is also about the first coming of Christ, but blends into the second coming in the verse in verse 4. But with righteousness shall he judge the poor, and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth, and shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked. This is not the average person's view of Jesus Christ, is it? Apparently, we heard this morning that a man on death row down in Huntsville, which is well known in Texas as the one major city from way back in the pre-Civil War period that was always a site of a major penitentiary. And there is a man running around loose, unless they've caught him by now, who had murdered two people and is apparently hiding out in a copse of woods while all of the people are searching for him with helicopters and dogs. And the idea of killing someone is so repugnant to an awful lot of people who are anti-capital punishment that they just cannot understand how the state of Texas could, even by the most humane method known to man, just a lethal injection which just puts them to sleep just like you would prior to an operation, and they don't feel anything at all, but just go into a deep sleep and they're dead. They're alive 1 minute and they're dead the next with absolutely no pain whatsoever. But they will just do everything. They will march and they will threaten and they will just try to unseat politicians and they will get all kinds of drives and everything going because they say that is murder. And they cannot imagine, because they look at Jesus Christ as the greatest pacifist in all of history, who, as they say, would not hurt a fly. A little game we used to play as a child was step on a crack and break your mother's back. So you didn't step on a crack. You hopscotch down the sidewalk going to church. And there are people that get the idea that you should not even slay an insect, and that even trees feel and cry when you pull their roots out of the ground. So it's carried to ridiculous extremes. But when you see that Jesus Christ of Nazareth is going to slay the wicked, and you read the 19th chapter of Revelation in the last half of it, where he physically takes the beast and the false prophet and hurls them over a precipice near Jerusalem called Hinnom, or into Gehenna fire, and there they burn alive, you can see that Jesus Christ is perfectly willing to carry out the deadly and horrible consequences of sin. With the breath of his lips, mean by a divine command, will he slay the wicked? And you know the prophecy that says that their flesh will actually just disintegrate right off of their bodies, and their eyes and tongues and the holes in their mouths will just disappear from apparently like a neutron bomb. But if you want to go back and ask what is the righteous wrath of the one we know of as Jesus Christ, the so-called humble carpenter from Nazareth, very misunderstood by most people, then go back and look at the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Because that was God's divine judgment on those cities that had become so completely perverse that they were not worth sparing alive. and even those in their society who were children, who had been so deeply affected by them, were burnt up. The whole society was completely obliterated by a divine nuclear explosion, virtually, like divine fire that came down from heaven in a fireball and burnt them all up. And I submit to you that there are millions of Baptists and Methodists and Episcopalians and Catholics and Protestants of every stripe who cannot imagine Jesus Christ with his eyes blazing in wrath and anger, putting to death anybody. But he is going to do it, and the prophecies say over and over again that he will do it. With the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked, and righteousness shall be the girdle of his loins, and faithfulness the girdle of his reins. It's like he is clothed with righteousness and faithfulness. Now it describes the condition of animals, the wolf and the leopard and the little kid and the fatling, the lion, a little child will lead them, and the cow and the bear shall feed. This is the millennial reign of Christ. The Seventh-day Adventist Church has no way to really explain this in the writings of Mrs. E.G. White that has everything absolutely out of kilter and backwards. There are no cows, wolves, leopards, asps, or, you know, poisonous snakes in heaven. And there are no little children in heaven. This is describing conditions on this earth, and it says that it's on the earth because it says in verse 9 that the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the eternal as the waters cover the sea. So it's a picture of the millennial reign of Christ and the change in the very nature of creatures from snakes to lions and tigers, where there will be no more predators and there will be no more poisonous vipers or stinging insects or things of that nature can be implied from the scripture. They, that is all these creatures, shall not hurt, verse 9, nor destroy in all my holy mountain, look at Isaiah 2 and Micah 4, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the eternal as the waters cover the sea. Now, that is the millennial reign of Christ, the beginning of the kingdom of God. And in that day there shall be a root of Jesse, referring back to verse 1 and 2, which shall stand for an ensign of the people, to it shall the Gentiles, translated nations, actually. The word Gentiles merely means nations other than Israel. And his rest shall be glorious, or glory, as the margin says. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left, from Assyria, and from Egypt, and from Pathros, which was Upper Egypt, and from Cush, and Elam, and Shinar, and Hamath, and the coastlands, as it should read, of the sea. Now, these are ancient areas, but Assyria and Egypt are certainly identified because Assyria was a very great and powerful nation at the time of Isaiah's prophecies, and Assyria was no more long before John wrote the book of Revelation. The Assyrians had been driven from their homeland by the Babylonians, and they were sister states, and they'd been subjugated by Babylon. And they, with the captives that they had taken and waves of invasion that came into Israel, had disappeared from the scene long before. Now, I have written extensively in the book called Europe and America in Prophecy on Germany in Prophecy, and who was King Ninus, after whom one of the earliest settlements in all of modern-day Germany was named, and it goes into detail about that, and of their worship of Nimrod, of their worship of the god of war, of Thor, and so on, and of certain traits and characteristics, the revering of women, the fact that they actually had optics, apparently, even in the days prior to Moses' day. And there is some reason to believe that because, as it was mentioned in some of the Assyriology that I studied in college, there were Babylonian cuneiform tablets that were only decipherable by optics. And so the conclusion was that if that is true, then they also, those marks had to be made by the use of some kind of optics. But that's beside the point. That is not a proof one way or the other. The proofs, I think, come from history and archaeology and biblical prophecy. Let's assume, and again I want to play pretend for a minute now in verse 11. Let's assume that those who reject the truth of the knowledge of the identity of Ephraim and Manasseh, and those who reject the truth that Britain and the Commonwealth of Nations are Ephraim, and the United States is Manasseh, and who insist that every time it mentions Israel, it means the Jews. Let's assume they're correct, and that is an absolutely false and erroneous assumption. So we're just pretending for a minute. And this just means Israel. Now think about the modern day geopolitical situation. Why is the United States so deeply embroiled in the so-called Middle Eastern peace process? Why did we send tens of thousands of young men and women once again, many of whom are still over there, others were about to pack up and leave when they were told, hold it, don't go yet, just a little over a week and a half or so ago, when we were going to go over there and bomb Saddam again, because of our fear and concern about him being able to, quote, threaten his neighbors, end quote. Now, while they voice the suspicion that Saddam would like to expand his empire into Saudi Arabia, which he would, and that he would like to attack Kuwait and absorb it as his 19th province that he tried before, which he would, remember that the first go-around back in February was when he suddenly began moving troops toward the south once again. And remember what they did when we bombed him at that time? You forget, I know, because people forget so quickly. There's just so much to keep track of in world news. Well, we bombed him in the north. You remember that? You've probably forgotten it, but go back and look. We bombed him in the north. He moved troops to the south, so we bombed him in the north. Anyway, that happened. So let's just assume. Now, I know that for all that they say about their worrying about Saddam being able with nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons to threaten his neighbors, and his neighbors being, they had a protracted 8-year war with Iran, but right now Iran and Iraq are cooperating, even though Iran never gave them back those hundreds of aircraft that fled over there to escape the Allied bombings. They'd have been shot down the minute they took off, as many of them were. And Iran has been given an air force, but it's not worth anything. It's been pointed out by the experts who know what they're talking about, like in Air Force magazine, because primarily they have no spare parts. And they've got a homogeneous mass of all kinds of aircraft, including from Russia and from France primarily, Mirage Mystères and so on, and they cannot repair them. And so only a tiny few of them are even flyable, and those will soon be worn out, and they won't be able to fly them anyway. But that's another beside the point. All of that is so much window dressing. The primary concern and consideration, yes, is oil. We know that, because 76% of the Japanese economy relies upon Middle Eastern Gulf oil, and 37% from the United States, and 56% from Europe as a whole relies upon oil coming from the Gulf states, the United Arab Emirates, a tremendous amount of it from Kuwait, tremendous amount of it from Saudi Arabia. And, of course, Iraq could be a very large oil producer if they would lift the sanctions, which Iraq wants them to do and is trying desperately to get them to do. Let's play pretend then. Let's say that Assyria is modern Iraq, which one person ludicrously, lugubriously, and virtually idiotically proposed on one occasion to me in all seriousness, so I'd understand prophecy better. All right? And from Egypt, what does Egypt mean? The gypsies? Well, the ancient Egyptians, I think you will find in both some of those who came in their reed rafts, and the ocean currents absolutely proved that in Thor Heyerdahl's two journeys from Kon-Tiki 1 and Kon-Tiki 2, who took a papyrus raft, went down from the Nile into the Mediterranean and allowed the currents to actually drift him all the way to, guess where? Central America, where there were races of pyramid builders all over the Yucatan Peninsula, all over Mexico. I've been to the top of the pyramid. It's called the Pirámides de San Juan de Teotihuacan in near Mexico City. And there's the Pyramid of the Sun, the Pyramid of the Moon, and so on, all over, pyramid builders there. The modern Egyptians are not the ancient Egyptians of the days of Moses. They are a completely different race of people. They are Arab, and the Egyptians of that day were not Arabs at all. And there are clues, because all of the people in Romania, in Bulgaria, and they were thick there, and in Hungary, and there were hundreds of thousands of them there, and in Germany, and eventually, because they had certain characteristics that the Nazi government didn't like, they were mercilessly put in torture camps and put to death. But they were the gypsies, and they were tinkers, and they were entertainers, And they were violinists, and they were dancers, and they were carnival sleight-of-hand sideshow card sharks, and they were fortune tellers, and they were known to deal in the black arts. And you can study, if you would like, as to where that term came from. And they were known all over Eastern Europe as Little Egypt, believe it or not. And maybe they are the remnants of those peoples who were driven out of Egypt and do not really even have a nation today. There are still many gypsies in the United States. There are many in England, but there are still many of them in Eastern Europe. We're pretending. Let's say that this is depicting the Jews and not the United States and not Britain. Well, verse 12, he, Jesus Christ, no argument there, the second coming of Christ, shall set up an ensign for the nations and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel, modern-day Jews. It's not true, but let's pretend. And gather together the dispersed of Judah. Who are they? Well, they're the same people, so it's redundant, isn't it? It says Israel, and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. So what does it tell you in that prophecy? It says, if you think it's only the Jews, that the entire population of modern-day Israel has been sent to nations all over the world, from Japan, even to America, I guess, to Canada, I guess, to where? India is mentioned here, Kush and Put, and Elam. Kush is the Indian nation, East Asian Indians and Pakistanis, same peoples with different religion, by the way. I mentioned Saddam and our commitment. But I can mention in passing as well the incredible number of Jews in the United States of America. Many people are anti-Semites and are virtually blind to the fact that only in America, this happens to be true, could the Jew flower and could bloom and could come to his or her fullest expression of the tremendous gifts that God has given those people in dozens of different directions. Our greatest musicians, our greatest, if there are great actors, our greatest geopoliticians, our greatest advisors to presidents, some say our greatest presidents because they think that Roosevelt's name was really Rosenfeld originally and that he was a Jew. So Hitler believed and other people, and I won't say that I'm convinced of that in any manner, shape, or form. But if you look at Hollywood, and we look at it with jaundiced eye, I know, but if you look at New York City and the financial community, look at the people you see interviewed, look at the names in some of those money market and fund managers and all that type of thing, and look at the names of the people who are predominant in some of those areas. For a time, I'm not sure it's true today with the immigrations from the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union, and from Yemen and Aden and so many other countries that have sent these dark, swarthy Jews and the Russian Jews and the European Jews back into Israel with the migrations, emigrations that have taken place. But it used to be stated that there were more Jews in New York City than there were in the little nation of Israel from 1948 to 1956. That may or may not have been true. All right. Pretending that it is the Jewish state, somebody then has conquered the Jewish state. Somebody is responsible for once again doing what? Deporting Jews. Where? Egypt. What a horrible place to send any Jewish family. Assyria. Where do you think that is? The one gentleman thought it was Iraq. Can you imagine the horrors? Here was a man who sent Scuds, and they've absolutely demonstrated now that some of the warheads that were blown up by Americans who blew up some of the ammunition dumps that were there in the forward areas where Saddam Hussein had them up there ready to load aboard some Scuds or even artillery shells, they discovered traces of VX, the deadliest chemical substance known to man, one drop of which in the back of your hand can kill you in a matter of, I guess, a few minutes. They discovered he already had the technology to produce it, and they've never discovered the place that he made it, or the cache, or the place where he's hidden it. And it's been pointed out that an amount that you could put in a little baggie from your kitchen, spread in the air over Washington, D.C., would exterminate the entire population. So you wonder why UNSCOM is over there looking. They want to look everywhere. it's impossible in a nation the size of Iraq, as big as California, for those people to find something the size of a baggie hidden away in somebody's closet somewhere, which could annihilate a city if it's merely sprinkled out of a light plane while it flies overhead, or if it is exploded in a canister aboard a rocket, which comes down and blows up over a populated center and thus disseminates this deadly, virulent poison in that fashion. Look at our little pretend scripture of verse 11 in that context, if you will, and ask yourself, would the United States be drawn in? Would Europe be drawn in? Would any self-respecting member of the Western democratic nations of the world be drawn in if once again Jews were being deported? Now, I mentioned how many Jews there are in the United States. I think few of us realize their political, their economic, and in many other ways, you could say, influence in the United States. I think we do not reckon with the power of the Jewish lobby. We don't reckon with the fact that decisions are taken with regard, for example, we, to this day, even though when he was over here and gave his address before the Congress and everybody applauded him very noisily when Benjamin Netanyahu said that they are going to be very shortly self-sufficient, we'll be able to tell America they don't need our aid anymore. Well, the congressmen were all really putting their hands together because that would be wonderful because the largest chunk of aid we send to any nation is sent to Israel. So while I'm saying it's all false and we're only pretending because we are a part of Israel and Ephraim is Great Britain and some of the democracies of northwestern Europe like the Scandinavian countries and so on, even if you think they are not, there is no way, if you believe this is a prophecy of God, if you believe it is the Word of God, if you believe it is an accurate portrayal of what takes place shortly after Christ plants his feet on the Mount of Olives, Zechariah 14:4, and one of the first things he's going to do is what? Regather Israel and, it says, the house of Judah from the four corners of the earth. Now let's go on and read the rest of it. The envy of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, and Judah shall not vex Ephraim. And there's the proof right there that we shouldn't be pretending, because Ephraim is not Yehudi, from which the term Jew comes and derives, but is a separate nation, and of course is one of the two upon whom dying Israel, or Jacob said, let my name be named on them, when he crossed his hands and blessed those two boys. But they shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west. They shall spoil them of the east together. It's interesting that the Philistines, or the Palestinians, or the Palestinians, which is what that really means, and they've never really been extirpated or exterminated from that land as God originally commissioned Joshua and his forces to do, and David warred against them for years, as you know. But they shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west. Interesting, toward the west, viewed from the standpoint of Israel. And where are they? In Gaza and right along the Mediterranean Sea coast. They shall lay their hand upon Edom and Moab, and the children of Ammon shall utterly obey them. And that may mean Iraq, and, of course, Turkey and Jordan. And the Eternal shall utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptian Sea, the seven great rivers there where the great Nile Delta divides into seven streams. With his mighty wind shall he shake his hand over the river and shall smite it in the seven streams and make men go over dry shod. And there shall be an highway for the remnant of his people which shall be left from Assyria, like as it was to Israel in the day that he came up out of the land of Egypt. In the Assyrian captivities under Shalmaneser, there was not a single one who ever returned to the land except a handful of people that the king himself sent back to teach the newly transplanted inhabitants of the cities of northern Israel how to defend themselves against the ravages of wild animals, if you remember reading about that in God's Word. But they did not return. It said that they stayed with the Assyrian captives, and they not a one of them returned to this day, as the Bible said. They migrated instead, and they left their names, Denester, Dnieper, Don, Udon, Danuba, etc., and of course, Dan Mark, and we know that half tribe of Dan abode in ships. So all of that that I have written on so extensively is absolutely true. But look at this. If you do play that little pretend, you cannot escape the absolute ultimate conclusion that at the time of the second coming of Christ, the entire Jewish nation is in a condition of captivity. Can you? Putting that together with Matthew 24, the duality of the meaning of Matthew 24, that what happened in 71 AD was merely a forerunner. Jesus Christ himself said the time is going to come when there will not be one stone left atop of another that shall not be thrown down. So we know that another, quote, Holocaust, end quote, is going to overtake the Jewish nation. By no stretch of anyone's imagination, and you can forget religion if you'd like. If you'd like, you can just forget the Bible if you'd like. People who are atheists can pretend there isn't even any God if they would like. And still, given that geopolitical scenario, America is going to be drawn into a gargantuan conflict against whichever power it is that occupies Israel. Right? You think it's going to be Iraq? You can think whoever you think. But I'd make the statement that if the nation of Israel is occupied by any foreign power of anybody's choosing, the United States is going to be in direct, immediate, massive conflict, warfare with that nation. Now, I have said these specific predictions time and time again, written them, stated them over and over and over again in the last number of years. Well, really for over 42 years, but certainly in the last 20, 25, and 30. I've said time and again, Germany would be reunited. It has been. As I said at the beginning of this talk, I expected that an awful lot of people would beat a path to my door and say, weren't you always saying this? And there was only one newspaper in Houston who gave me a call and said, weren't you always saying something like this? And then I think they did write a little article about it, and maybe I've got a copy of that somewhere in a file. But they were the only people, not one television station, not one single radio station, not one national commentator of any kind, and yet I'd been saying it repetitively over and over and over again to about 20 million American people, time and time again, maybe several times a week, for literally decades. I said Germany would be reunited. It has been. I said the Berlin Wall would come down, that Berlin would be reunited and become the capital city of Germany. The buildings are almost complete. The new Reichstag is almost complete. It has a big glass dome. Guess when they begin to move? January 1999. As they call for a federated Europe, as a common European currency is put in place, and as a German ascends to the chairmanship of United Europe. The German government, the last vestiges of it, will move from Bonn to Berlin. I named European countries that would come out from behind the Iron Curtain, and there are volumes of proof in tapes and in booklets and articles by the score. East Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania. I said it time and again before audiences numbering into the thousands. I said time and again, Russia is not the beast and will not invade and occupy Palestine. I still say that. I said the United States of Europe will probably not arise from a peaceful coalition of nations in Europe or out of the EEC, but will instead arise as a result of a coming global economic collapse. And we're in the midst of what? A global economic crisis with stock markets going like a roller coaster, which many nations say might have the word finish written to it when Y2K comes into play on January 1st, 2000. I said that would in turn lead to the rise of dictatorships, despots, and the imposition of martial law, and that military governments would be put in place, and then we would see the beast power coalesce, and that these kings would endure with the beast but 1 hour, a very short period of time. Out of that great post-depression crash would emerge the beast power. Now what is in place right now today? Many Islamic and third world countries are working on chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons and threatening Israel. Europe is moving toward economic and now political unity. The United States is seen as weak and vacillating, and Ezekiel 7:1 through 20 says that the trumpet would sound and no man would be able to answer, and then I finally end up with this final comment. And at the same time, all of these things are to obtain in world geopolitical conditions what would be happening to God's church. When he shall have accomplished the power, to scatter rather, the power of the holy people, then all these things will come to pass. It makes you wonder, no matter who the man is, that when a man has built an organization and comes up to the point to where he is apparently successful and has a meaningful program and is reaching a lot of people on television, all of a sudden he's forced to start all over again. It makes you wonder as you look at the whole picture. Your newspapers may or may not report what the German foreign minister said. Looking at the obtuse, don't care, non-involved, uninterested attitude of the American population and its fascination with Monica, I would dare say you probably won't read about it in your daily newspapers, but you will read about it in the next issue of the publications that I'm putting out, including the newspaper. Well, the newspaper's too late for that, but the next issue of World Watch. And guess what the title of my next, or guess what the subject of my next television program is going to be on Monday?